You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Esoteric Christianity and the Mission of Christian Rosenkreuz, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 4, entitled Rosicrucian Christianity, the first of two lectures given at Neuschâtel, excuse my pronunciation, on the 27th of September 1911. It gives me great joy to be here for the first time, in this newly founded group bearing the great name of Christian Rosenkreuz, which gives me the opportunity for the first time of speaking about Christian Rosenkreuz at greater length. What is contained in the mystery of Christian Rosenkreuz? I cannot tell you all about this individuality in one evening, so we shall speak about Christian Rosenkreuz himself today, and tomorrow we shall talk about his work. To speak about Christian Rosenkreuz presupposes great trust in the mysteries of spiritual life. Trust not only in the person himself, but in the great secrets of the life of the Spirit. The founding of a new group, likewise, also always presupposes faith in spiritual life. Christian Rosenkreuz is an individual who is active both when he is in incarnation and when he is not incarnated in a physical body. He works not only as a physical being and through physical forces, but above all spiritually, through higher forces. As we know, man lives not only for himself, but also in connection with human evolution as a whole. Usually, when someone passes through death, his etheric body dissolves into the cosmos. A part of this dissolving etheric body always stays intact, however, and so we are always surrounded by these remaining parts of the etheric bodies of the dead, for our good, or also to our detriment. They affect us for good or ill, according to whether we ourselves are good or bad. Far-reaching effects emanate also from the etheric bodies of great individualities. Great forces emanating from the etheric body of Christian Rosenkreuz can work into our soul and also into our spirit. It is our duty to get to know these forces, for we work with them as Rosicrucians. Strictly speaking, the Rosicrucian movement began in the 13th century. At that time, these forces worked extraordinarily strongly, and a Christian Rosenkreuz stream has been active in spiritual life ever since. There is a law that this spiritual stream of force has to become especially powerful every 100 years or so. This is to be seen now in the Theosophical movement. Christian Rosenkreuz himself gave an indication of this in his last Esoteric statements. In the year 1785, the collected esoteric revelations of the Rosicrucians appeared in the work titled The Secret Symbols of the Rosicrucians by Hinrichus Matathanas Theosophus. In a certain limited sense, this publication contains references to the Rosicrucian stream active in the previous century, which was revealed for the first time in the works collected and put together by Hinrichus Matathanas Theosophus. Another 100 years later, we see the influence of the Rosicrucian stream coming to expression again in the work of H. P. Blavatsky, especially in the book titled Isis Unveiled. A considerable amount of Western occult wisdom is contained in this book that is still a long way from being improved upon, even though the composition is sometimes very confused. It is interesting to compare, titled The Secret Symbols of the Rosicrucians by Hinrichus Matathanas Theosophus, with the works of H. P. Blavatsky. We must think especially of the first part of the publication, which is written in symbolic form, in quotes. In the second part, Blavatsky deviates a little from the Rosicrucian stream. In her later works she departs entirely from it, and we must be able to distinguish between her early and her later publications. even though something of her uncritical spirit already appears in the early ones. That this is said is no more than the wish of H.P. Blavatsky herself, who is not in incarnation now. When we look at the characteristic quality of human consciousness in the 13th century, we see that primitive clairvoyance had gradually disappeared. We know that in earlier times everybody had an elementary clairvoyance. In the middle of the 13th century, this reached its lowest point, and there was suddenly no more clairvoyance. Everyone experienced a spiritual eclipse. Even the most enlightened spirits and the most highly developed individuals, including initiates, had no further access to the spiritual worlds. And when they spoke about the spiritual worlds, they had to confine themselves to what remained in their memories. People only knew about the spiritual world from tradition or from those initiates who awakened their memories of what they had previously experienced. For a short time, though, even these minds could not see directly into the spiritual world. This short period of darkness had to take place at that time to prepare for what is characteristic of our present age, today's intellectual, rational development. That is what is important today in the fifth post-Atlantean cultural epoch. In the Greco-Roman cultural epoch, the development of the intellect was not as it is today. Direct perception was the vital factor, not intellectual thinking. Human beings identified with what they saw and heard, in fact, even with what they thought. They did not produce thoughts from out of themselves then, as we do today, and as we ought to do, for this is the task of the fifth post-Atlantean cultural epoch. Man's clairvoyance gradually begins again after this time, and the clairvoyance of the future can now develop. The Rosicrucian stream began in the 13th century. During that century, individuals particularly suitable for initiation had to be specially chosen. Initiation could take place only after the short period of darkness had run its course. In a place in Europe that cannot be named yet, though this will be possible in the not very distant future, a lodge of a very spiritual nature was formed, comprising a council of 12 men who had received into themselves the sum of the spiritual wisdom of olden times and of their own time. Thus we are concerned with 12 men who lived in that dark era, 12 outstanding individualities who united to help the progress of humanity. None of them could see directly into the spiritual world, but they could awaken to life in themselves memories of what they had experienced through earlier initiations. And the karma of mankind brought it about that everything that still remained to mankind of the ancient Atlantean epoch was incarnated in 7 of these 12. In my title Outline of Esoteric Science, it has already been stated that in the 7 holy rishis of old, the teachers of the ancient Indian cultural epoch, all that was left of the Atlantean epoch was preserved. These 7 men who were incarnated again in the 13th century, and who were part of the Council of 12, were those who could look back into the 7 streams of the ancient Atlantean cultural epoch of mankind, and the further course of these streams. Each of these 7 individualities could bring one stream to life for their time and our present time. In addition to these 7, there were another 4 who could not look back into times long past, but could look back to the occult wisdom mankind had acquired in the 4 post-Atlantean epochs. The first could look back to the ancient Indian period, the second to the ancient Persian cultural period, the third to the Egyptian, Chaldean, Assyrian, Babylonian cultural period, and the fourth to the Greco-Roman culture. These 4 joined the 7 to form a Council of Wise Men in the 13th century. A 12th had the fewest memories, as it were. However, he was the most intellectual among them, and it was his task to foster external science in particular. These 12 individualities not only lived in the experiences of Western occultism, but these 12 different streams of wisdom worked together to make a whole. A remarkable reference to this can be found in Goethe's poem titled The Mysteries. We shall be speaking, then, of 12 outstanding individualities. The middle of the 13th century is the time when a new culture began. At this time, a certain low point of spiritual life had been reached. Even the most highly developed could not approach the spiritual worlds. Then it was that the council of these most spiritually advanced people assembled. These 12 men, who represented the sum of all the spiritual knowledge of their age and the 12 schools of thought, came together in a place in Europe that cannot as yet be named. This council of the 12 only possessed clairvoyant memory and intellectual wisdom. The 7 successors of the 7 rishis remembered their ancient wisdom, and the other 5 represented the wisdom of the 5 post-Atlantean cultures. Thus the 12 represented the whole of Atlantean and post-Atlantean wisdom. The 12th was a man who attained the intellectual wisdom of his time in the highest degree. He possessed intellectually all the knowledge of his time, whilst the others, to whom direct spiritual vision was also then denied, acquired their knowledge by returning in memory to their earlier incarnations. The beginning of a new culture was only possible, however, because a 13th came to join the 12. The 13th did not become a scholar in the accepted sense of that time. He was an individuality who had been incarnated at the time of the mystery of Golgotha. In the incarnations that followed, he prepared himself for his mission through humility of soul and through a fervent life devoted to God. He was a great soul, a pious, deeply mystical human being, who had not just acquired these qualities, but was born with them. If you imagine a young man who is very pious, and who devotes all his time to fervent prayer to God, then you can have a picture of this 13th individuality. He grew up entirely under the care and instruction of the 12, and he received as much wisdom as each could give him. He was educated with the greatest care, and every precaution was taken to see that no one other than the 12 exercised an influence on him. He was kept apart from the rest of the world. He was a very delicate child in that incarnation of the 13th century, and therefore the education that the 12 bestowed upon him worked right into his physical body. Now the 12, being deeply devoted to their spiritual tasks and inwardly permeated with Christianity, were conscious that the external Christianity of the Church was only a caricature of real Christianity. They were permeated with the greatness of Christianity, although in the outside world they were regarded as its enemies. Each individuality worked his way into just one aspect of Christianity. Their endeavor was to unite the various religions into one great whole. They were convinced that the whole of spiritual life was contained in their 12 streams, and each one influenced the pupil to the best of his ability. Their aim was to achieve a synthesis of all the religions, but they knew that this was not to be achieved by means of any theory, but only through active spiritual life. And for this, a suitable education of the 13th was essential. Whilst the spiritual forces of the 13th increased beyond measure, his physical forces drained away. It came to the point when he almost ceased to have any further connection with external life, and all interest in the physical world disappeared. He lived entirely for the sake of the spiritual development which the 12 were bringing about in him. The wisdom of the 12 was reflected in him. It reached the point where the 13th refused to eat and wasted away. Then an event occurred that could only happen once in history. It was the kind of event that can take place when the forces of the macrocosm cooperate for the sake of what they can bring to fruition. After a few days, the body of the 13th became quite transparent, and for days he lay as though dead. The 12 now gathered round him at certain intervals. At these moments all knowledge and wisdom flowed from their lips. Whilst the 13th lay as though dead, they let their wisdom flow toward him in short, prayer-like formula. The best way to imagine them is to picture the 12 in a circle round the 13th. This situation ended when the soul of the 13th awakened like a new soul. He had experienced a great transformation of soul. Within him there now existed something that was like a completely new birth of the 12 streams of wisdom, so that the 12 wise men could also learn something entirely new from the youth. His body, too, came to life now in such a way that this revival of his absolutely transparent body was beyond compare. The youth could now speak of quite new experiences. The 12 could recognize that he had experienced the event of Damascus. It was a repetition of the vision of Paul on the road to Damascus. In the course of a few weeks, the 13th reproduced all the wisdom he had received from the 12, but in a new form. This new form was as though given by Christ himself. What he now revealed to them, the 12 called true Christianity, the synthesis of all the religions. And they distinguished between this true Christianity and the Christianity of the period in which they lived. The 13th died relatively young, and the 12 then devoted themselves to the task of recording what the 13th had revealed to them in imaginations, for it could only be done in that way. Thus came the symbolic figures and images contained in the collection of Henricus Matathanus Theosophus and the communications of H. P. Blavatsky in the work titled Isis Unveiled. We have to see the occult process in such a way that the fruits of the initiation of the 13th remained as the residue of his etheric body within the spiritual atmosphere of the earth. This residue inspired the 12, as well as their pupils, who succeeded them so that they could form the occult Rosicrucian stream. Yet it continued to work as an etheric body, and it then became part of the new etheric body of the 13th, when he incarnated again. The individuality of the 13th reincarnated as early as halfway through the 14th century. In this incarnation, he lived for over 100 years. He was brought up in a similar way, in the circle of the pupils and successors of the 12, but not so secluded as in his previous incarnation. When he was 28 years old, he conceived a remarkable ideal. He had to leave Europe and travel. First he went to Damascus, and what Paul had experienced there happened again to him. This event can be described as the fruits of what took place in the previous incarnation. All the forces of the wonderful etheric body of the individuality of the 13th century had remained intact, none of them dispersed after death into the general world ether. This was a permanent etheric body, remaining intact in the ether spheres thereafter. This same highly spiritual etheric body again radiated from the spiritual world into the new incarnation, the individuality in the 14th century. Therefore he was led to experience the event of Damascus again. This is the individuality of Christian Rosenkreutz. He was the 13th in the circle of the 12. He was named thus from this incarnation onward. Esoterically, in the occult sense, he was already Christian Rosenkreutz in the 13th century, but exoterically, he was named thus only from the 14th century. And the pupils of this 13th are the successors of the other 12 in the 13th century. These are the Rosicrucians. At that time, Christian Rosenkreutz traveled through the whole of the known world. After he had received all the wisdom of the 12, fructified by the mighty being of the Christ, it was easy for him to receive all the wisdom of that time in the course of 7 years. When, after 7 years, he returned to Europe, he took the most highly developed pupils and successors of the 12 as his pupils, and then began the actual work of the Rosicrucians. By the grace of what radiated from the wonderful etheric body of Christian Rosenkreutz, they could develop an absolutely new world conception. What has been developed by the Rosicrucians up to our time is work of both an outer and an inner nature. The outer work was for the purpose of discovering what lies behind the Maya of the material world. They wanted to investigate the Maya of matter. Just as man has an etheric body, so does the whole of the macrocosm have an etheric macrocosm, an etheric body. There is a certain point of transition from the coarser to the finer substance. Let us look at the boundary between physical and etheric substance. What lies between physical and etheric substance is like nothing else in the world. It is neither gold nor silver, lead nor copper. It is something that cannot be compared with any other physical substance, yet it is the essence of all of them. It is a substance that is contained in every other physical substance, so that the other physical substances can be considered to be modifications of this one substance. To see this substance clairvoyantly was the endeavor of the Rosicrucians. The preparation, the development of such vision, they saw to require a heightened activity of the soul's moral forces, which would then enable them to see this substance. They realized that the power for this vision lay in the moral power of the soul. This substance was really seen and discovered by the Rosicrucians. They found that this substance lived in the world in a certain form, both in the macrocosm and in man. In the world outside man, they revered it as the mighty garment of the macrocosm. They saw it arising in man when there is an harmonious interplay between thinking and willing. They saw the will forces as being not only in man, but in the macrocosm also, for instance, in thunder and lightning. And they saw the forces of thought on the one hand in man, and also outside in the world, in the rainbow and the rosy light of dawn. The Rosicrucians sought the strength to achieve such harmony of willing and thinking in their own soul, in the forces radiating from this etheric body of the 13th, Christian Rosenkreutz. It was established that all the discoveries they made had to remain the secret of the Rosicrucians for 100 years, and that not until 100 years had passed might these Rosicrucian revelations be divulged to the world. For not until they had worked at them for 100 years might they talk about them in an appropriate way. Thus what appeared in 1785 in the work titled The Secret Symbols of the Rosicrucians was being prepared from the 17th to the 18th century. Now it is also of great importance to know that in any century the Rosicrucian inspiration is given in such a way that the name of the one who receives the inspiration is never made public. Only the highest initiates know it. Today, for instance, only those occurrences can be made public that happened 100 years ago, for that is the time that must pass before it is permissible to speak of it in the outside world. The temptation is too great that people would fanatically idealize a person bearing such authority, which is the worst thing that can happen. It would be too near to idolatry. This silence, however, is not only essential in order to avoid the outer temptations of ambition and pride, which could probably be overcome, but above all, to avoid occult astral attacks, which would be constantly directed at an individuality of that caliber. That is why it is an essential condition that a fact like this can only be spoken of after 100 years. Through the works of the Rosicrucians, the etheric body of Christian Rosenkreuz became ever stronger and mightier from century to century. It worked not only through Christian Rosenkreuz, but through all those who became his pupils. From the 14th century onward, Christian Rosenkreuz has been incarnated again and again. Everything that is made known in the name of theosophy is strengthened by the etheric body of Christian Rosenkreuz, and those who make theosophy known let themselves be overshadowed by this etheric body that can work on them both when Christian Rosenkreuz is incarnated and when he is not in incarnation. The Count of Saint Germain was the exoteric name of Christian Rosenkreuz's incarnation in the 18th century. This name was given to other people too. Therefore, not everything that is told about Count Saint Germain here and there in the outside world applies to the real Christian Rosenkreuz. Christian Rosenkreuz is incarnated again today. The inspiration for the work of H.P. Blavatsky, Isis Unveiled, came from the strength radiating from his etheric body. It was also Christian Rosenkreuz's influence working invisibly on Lessing that inspired him to write Titled The Education of the Human Race, 1780. Because of the rising tide of materialism, it became more and more difficult for inspiration to come about in the Rosicrucian way. Then, in the 19th century, came the high tide of materialism. Many things could only be given very incompletely. In 1851, the problem of the immortality of the soul was resolved by Widenmann through the idea of reincarnation. His text was awarded a prize. Even around 1850, Drosbach wrote from a psychological point of view in support of reincarnation. Thus, the forces radiating from the etheric body of Christian Rosenkreuz continued to be active in the 19th century too. And a renewal of theosophical life could come about because, by 1899, the short Kali Yuga had run its course. That is why it is now easier to approach the spiritual world, and spiritual influence is possible to a far greater degree. The etheric body of Christian Rosenkreuz has become very powerful, and through devotion to this, man will be able to acquire new clairvoyance and invoke lofty spiritual forces. This will only be possible, however, for those people who follow the training of Christian Rosenkreuz correctly. Until now, an esoteric Rosicrucian preparation was essential. But the 20th century has the mission of enabling this etheric body to become so mighty that it can also work exoterically. Those affected by it will be granted experience of the event that Paul experienced on the road to Damascus. Until now, this etheric body has only worked upon the Rosicrucian school. In the 20th century, more and more people will be able to experience the effect of it. And through this, they will come to experience the appearance of Christ in the etheric body. It is the work of the Rosicrucians that makes possible the etheric vision of Christ. The number of people who will become capable of seeing it will grow and grow. We must attribute this reappearance to the important work of the 12th and the 13th in the 13th and 14th centuries. If you can become an instrument of Christian Rosenkreuz, then you can be assured that the tiniest soul steps you take will be there for eternity. Tomorrow we will come to speak about the work of Christian Rosenkreutz. A vague longing for spiritual science is present in mankind today, and we can be sure that wherever students of Rosicrucianism are striving seriously and conscientiously, they are working creatively for eternity. Every spiritual achievement, however small, brings us further. It is essential to understand and revere these holy matters. The end of Lecture 4.